On this week's CoinGeek Conversations, why would you leave a successful BSV incubator program to start an AI incubator? I'll be asking serial entrepreneur Craig Massey. And I'll be finding out about how closely software can simulate human interaction from conversation scientist Professor Elizabeth Stocker. But first, let me reveal where I am and what's going on.
So I'm here at the London Chatbot Summit. Now, I thought that was just going to be a whole lot of chatbots having important conversations with each other. But no, it's actually people talking about chatbots. And what's different this year is that it's all going to be about AI.
You're listening to CoinGeek Conversations with Charles Miller.
Chatbots have been around for years trying to answer our questions, but the industry is being supercharged by the arrival of AI.
I'm not an expert on the chatbot industry, but then, of course, I don't have to be. Alexa, how big is the chatbot industry?
From ByteScout.com. It is a big industry, and according to reports, the chatbot market will reach $10.08 billion by 2026.
Woo, big business then.
That's a clue as to why Craig Massey left the blockchain incubator he founded and moved on to his next idea.
So we've now started a new incubator, which is called AI Forge. Having started Block Dojo, and believe it or not, in 2022, Block Dojo accounted for 24% of all blockchain startups. Not a bad start. So we've kind of taken all the learnings from a blockchain incubator, transposed it into an AI incubator, but we've raised more money and we're doing things on a kind of a grander scale.
Well, AI seems to be where it's at these days, or to put it in a negative way, it's the latest thing and maybe in a few years something else will come along. How do you compare AI with blockchain as industries?
It's 20 times larger. And corporates are a lot more kind of passionate. As we know, corporates were always very hesitant because, you know, there's a bit of a civil war going on with blockchain. Obviously, it's all tarnished with, you know, the ICO scams and, you know, the crypto and all. You know, I used to spend 50% of my time explaining what blockchain wasn't rather than what it was. Now, we're still big, passionate advocates of blockchain. And it actually dovetails quite nicely with quite a few of our AI startups. So for instance, you know, everybody knows fake news. Everybody knows that, you know, AI, left alone, it can kind of start to fool itself. So blockchain is perfect to kind of add some rigor, and particularly, you know, in sort of content creation and rights management and all the rest of it.
Right. So you could use blockchain with AI to sort of say where the AI information is coming from.
Yeah.
And just, it's probably hard to answer this in general terms, but in terms of business models for AI startups, how do they kind of typically work? Where's the money? Where are the profits going to come from?
One of the things I do inside the Forge is do their financial models. And because corporates are a lot more involved in this, there are juicier budgets. Because if you imagine, in our cohort of 12 in London, four or five of them are doing kind of back office, kind of boring stuff, really, but very vital. Because huge companies have awful processes. You know, and it may touch way too many people's hands and there's too much kind of regulation and bureaucracy and AI can come in, it can understand data, you know, and it can organize it more efficiently.
So these businesses will be providing services that big companies will pay for on a subscription basis or something like that?
Yeah, exactly. So there's a lot of kind of like SaaS license products that are in cohort one. In fact, predominantly, I don't think we've got any business to consumer. I think it's all business to business.
Right. Because, I mean, looking at Block Dojo, there's some brilliant ideas, but I can't really think of one where money was going to pour in from day one. I mean, it was all like little slices of tiny transaction fees and things. You're not in that
You'd be territory. Surprised. I mean, you know, we're still in touch with cohort one, cohort two, and, you know, there are some outstanding companies, actually. Three of the dojo companies have been offered money to actually be bought out.
Really?
You know, now, at this stage, it's only kind of 7 million or 10 million, and, you know, it's too small. But already, considering we only kind of started the first cohort and it finished last April, that's quite amazing in kind of less than 18 months, and they're getting offered, you know, £10 million to be bought out.
And is that because they are showing profitability?
Well, that's another matter. So profitability in the first 2 or 3 years is almost impossible. What they are doing is they're showing kind of traction and growth and interest from major corporates.
Right, right. Well, getting back to the AI thing then, are you using, or are your startups using ChatGPT and existing AI businesses that we've all heard of, or anybody who's taken an interest in it, or are they tending to create their own LLMs, large language models?
It's a mixed bag, but we definitely have seen the applications. So we had 324 applications into cohort one. We've already surpassed that, ready for cohort two. It's quite something to kind of try to narrow down to. We have the final 30. We now put them in front of a big judging panel. We have the head of AI for Google, Meta, etc. So
they're on the judging panel.
Yeah, yeah. This is why AI is just, it's very easy. We do an outreach and they say yes, you know, and they're part of this. It's kind of a more rigorous process now to get it down to the final 12. But I would say it's about 80-20. The applications we've had in are clever, more productized people who are building on one of the big AI platforms.
You mean that's the 80?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Right. The vast majority, yeah. Who are very clever. They come in with a niche solution, a few hundred lines of code sitting on top of one of the main AI platforms. 20% are the traditional, you know, which are, you know, the PhD guys who've been tinkering with their train set for the last 10 years, you know, and they kind of like to do that research. But that's kind of more deep tech, machine learning. That's more of a kind of a long term.
So those are the people who are developing their own models.
Yeah. And you know, it takes an awful lot of resource. It takes an army of very bright people. But in terms of the applications into our cohort, it is about 80-20. Hmm. So, and what we believe is going to happen is because we're getting corporates together. So I've now employed a partnership director, and his job is to actually bring together corporates who are very interested, who are going to sign LOIs. Letters of intent, right? Or, you know, POCs, proof of concept. And what they will want to do is once they've built some sort of solution, they'll want to test it very quickly. And our prediction is they'll probably want to snap them up before it ever gets anywhere near a Series A, which means that what we'll see is lots of kind of trade sale exits, probably for 30, 40 million pounds, you know, before it kind of gets anywhere.
That's just after a few months' work then.
And 3 years, perhaps. Yeah. So, but then, of course, then you'll have the PhDs who will, it's a longer burn. It's, you know, more capital intensive.
Yeah.
It's, you know, it's the more traditional Series A, Series B, you know, off, you know, marching towards being a unicorn, et cetera.
I mean, looking at that 80% side of things, I mean, when the internet started and there was the dot-com boom, there were a lot of people, everyone wanted to start their own dot-com.
Right.
And they were able to sort of do, some of them do very, very well because the internet was there as a kind of piece of infrastructure that you could just find a clever way of using it.
Precisely.
And it seems to me like in relation to ChatGPT or whatever, these guys, if you can find a way of just sort of tapping into it and providing something that consumers can use very easily, then is it sort of in a way a similar kind of model, would you say?
It is. However, they're a lot smarter. There is a bigger cost implication to actually use these big platforms. You know, some of them, you're doing kind of lots of data intensive.
Because these platforms are pretty smart about making sure that they don't give stuff away.
So we have to, you know, we model that in. So some of them have got fantastic revenue streams, but then actually there's some very hefty costs associated with that. So we, you know, you have to kind of balance them out and you have to work out, is this, does this business make sense?
Right. Well, it's interesting because, I mean, AI is such a new industry. I mean, you are very experienced entrepreneur in all sorts of different fields, but I'm not being rude if I say that you're not an AI expert, or at least perhaps haven't,
not even close.
But exactly. I mean, so tell me about the sort of challenge that you have in looking at these people with their bright ideas and knowing which is a good one and which is not a good one when AI is new basically to everybody.
It's a good question, and you know, even I had imposter syndrome at my age, which is a bit hard to believe, right? Okay. But it does help having this kind of stellar panel. So the panel, the judging panel, is everybody from AI professors. We've got some AI founders who've had successful exits. We've got the kind of the glitterati.
So in a way, what you bring to the party in part is a network and an ability to create a new network of these
people.
This
is what we did. I mean, it was a brand new ecosystem. We had to kind of reach out to lots of people, and that was actually surprisingly easy. But then once they're through the gate, I promise you, they're exactly like any other business. Apart from actually, it's a little bit easier to determine the revenues with these guys because it's an easier known, you know, sort of conversion metric in terms of reaching out to corporates. And we understand, you know, well, how successful will you be if you do this various marketing activity? And then once you're through the gate with a corporate, takes, you know, a gestation period until they say yes. But then once you're in, it's, you know, it's a SaaS model. And that's when you can extrapolate the revenues.
So there's a lot of talk about potential regulation of the AI industry. Is that something that you worry about that might start putting the brake on things?
I think corporates are going to lead the charge on this. PwC, for instance, predicted in a very detailed report that AI was going to improve global GDP equivalent to essentially UK, Germany, France, Italy, half a dozen countries' entire GDP is going to be improved. So because there's so much benefit that corporates could envisage, I think they will be kind of driving this. So yes, of course, there are some naysayers in terms of the, you know, and quite right. I mean, but I don't think it will actually affect the, you know, us creating new companies at this kind of level. I think that's a much more kind of ethereal level that we don't get involved in.
I mean, this really does seem like an incredible opportunity. What is your feeling about having made this switch from Blockdojo to AI Forge?
Well, first of all, we went out and raised money very easily, very quickly. We've raised £24 million of pledges. So we were able to launch in London and Miami at exactly the same time. We've given birth to 23 companies from September the 2nd. So we're already looking at, and we're opening up two new cities per year thereafter. So our next two cities are Austin and Hyderabad. And then the year after, it will be Vancouver and Singapore. So already we've started interviewing in terms of getting the teams in place for both Austin and Hyderabad. So it's exciting, it's interesting. But I think the great thing is, it will be a beautiful confluence between blockchain and AI. For me, they're not like two separate technologies. They're a perfect marriage. And particularly with all the negative things that everyone talks about with AI, blockchain fixes many of those things. Okay. So I think we just need more examples. And we've only just started, and already of our 12, two or three other companies are all already incorporating blockchain in their proposition.
Craig, it's been brilliant to catch up with you. Congratulations on what you've already achieved with AI Forge, and really, really good
luck
with it.
Good to see you again, Charles.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Several founders from the first AI Forge group of startups in Craig's program are here today touting for business. So can you tell me what ConveyGuru is?
Yeah, ConveyGuru is a product that helps legal professionals to streamline their communication.
On average, we find out that legal professionals spend more than a third of their time dealing with admin tasks, especially with client inquiries. So we're trying to take that burden out of their shoulders.
And how does AI come into it?
So AI is just a means of automation. So we help them to either draft responses, we help them to categorize incoming emails, we help them to be on the top of their communications, basically.
Now, I understand you don't really like the word chatbot. What do you have instead?
Yeah, correct. So we position ourselves as a smart assistant. So we are acting as junior staff supporting solicitors on a daily basis.
So should junior staff who work for solicitors be worried about their jobs?
No, absolutely not. They are going to be also the users. So we want them to progress faster to become solicitors, you know, more senior ones.
Another AI Forge startup wants to help banks and other big players avoid getting into trouble with regulators.
We provide software for regulated industries to help them prevent penalties and fines that the regulators are putting them on.
And it's a chatbot, so who's going to be using it?
Yeah, so it's a chatbot is one half of it, where you know, CEO, CTO, or head of compliance are the people who will use it, but also the data engineers who need to go and get data for various reports. This is like a co-pilot for them to help them create those reports.
As a chatbot, how much better is it because of AI?
Yeah, so we would say that it is this, whatever we are doing with the chatbot, it couldn't have been possible without large language models behind it. What it does is it is able to comprehend the knowledge graph for the organization, and it is able to provide the risk profile that an organization carries on their processes, which is important for organizations to understand to adhere to certain regulations.
If you're working with banks and other big financial institutions, you've got to make sure you get the answers right, haven't you? Because otherwise there could be big financial implications. How are you going to do that?
Yeah, absolutely. So we've got a three-layered architecture for our product. The second layer, which is tuned especially on the industry itself, It knows what a transaction, for a banking, for example, it knows what a transaction is, it knows what a bank account, current saving. So it has got a feeling of understanding of how the business itself works. And then on the third layer, we've got all the personality for the client itself. So the same product deployed in Lloyds Banking Group will be very different from the product deployed in HSBC because we have incorporated the personality in it. We are also doing away with hallucination by providing the data. And if the hallucinations within AI... So that is something that, you know, when the model doesn't know something, it'll just make up stuff. So because we have got our own proprietary model as the core of it, we have stopped it from answering something that it doesn't know. So it'll just say that I don't know. And that's a better answer than saying, making something up.
That's what a human being should do as well, isn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. But most of the time, I suppose they don't.
If AI is going to produce much smarter chatbots, are they going to be as good as people?
Alexa, what is the difference between a chatbot and a human being?
From ResearchGate.net, it is worth noting that the crucial difference among chatbots and humans is the perception of empathy, as chatbots are less capable of conversational understanding than humans are.
So, Elizabeth, you're an expert on the science of conversation. How does that relate to the chatbot industry exactly?
I guess conversation analysts, like myself, are interested in people talking to each other. And I guess the clue's in the name, so chat, bot. One of the questions might be, do chatbots actually chat? And do these conversational technologies actually leverage what we know from research on conversation into their products? And that's kind of why I'm interested and probably why I'm here today.
Right. Oh, well, I'd love to talk about that. But let's just go back to basics about your work. How do you collect data and how do you come to your conclusions about how a conversation works?
Conversation analysts use recordings of actual interactions that are happening a bit like this one in the wild. Quite often encounters are recorded already, so a lot of organizations already record all of their incoming calls for training and research purposes.
Yeah, so you hear that so often.
We do.
You're on the phone. Yeah.
And so sometimes I am, you know, using research access to those calls. Sometimes people will actually, you know, set up a camera or an audio and record things. But the the unique part of conversation analysis really is to look at these actual interactions. So we don't analyze simulated or role-played interactions. We don't ask people later in an interview or on a survey to report on their conversations. We look at what actually happened in an interaction from the moment it starts until the moment it ends, everything that happens along the way.
Right. So if you get a bunch of data that has been recorded for training purposes, as the person on the phone has been told, what kind of thing would you be looking for and how would you kind of come to that conclusion?
Yeah. So the first sort of big study that I did that made me realize that some of what I'm doing will have a relevance to not just me as an academic, but to organizations and industry as well, was looking at initial inquiry calls to community mediation services, where at the end of the call, the person who has telephoned, who's got a neighbour dispute, may or may not become a client of that service within the call. So some people will say yes and become a client, and some people say no. And so in those initial inquiries, you start to see when you collect a lot of them that there is a kind of architecture to them. There's a journey that people go on. There are key moments which are the points of engagement or disengagement. And so I was able to identify, describe, and share what it is that engages or disengages people from participating in mediation, write the research, and then suddenly became quite popular with mediators who actually wanted to know what I'd found, because if they don't get clients in those calls, they can't then do mediation.
We're here at this chatbot conference, and chatbots kind of have a bit of a bad press, I think, because people, I don't know, perhaps feel a bit insulted that they are being talked to by a machine. And I know in your work, you look at the little hesitations and even the way somebody says, or whatever.
Yeah.
No chatbots have that content in them. Is there a sort of a kind of absolute difference between a chatbot and a person, in the sense that a chatbot is not going to have those sort of hesitations because it's programmed to say what it's going to say, and that therefore there'll always be that kind of divide?
Yeah, maybe. And I think it's an interesting question, because of course when we write to each other on a messaging app, for instance, we will put some of that stuff into our writing. So, you know, someone will send you a message and you'll write back, ? And so we actually put those features quite often into our writing. And I say that because that means that they can go into a written chatbot script if you want them to be there. But then you just have to ask the question, well, where do people use these ums and ahs and hesitations and so on? Are they just randomly sort of splattered around interaction? Well, the answer to that is no, they're not. They're quite systematically placed in overall turns. And so I could imagine a world where someone writes a chatbot script, they add in some ums and ahs to make it sound more human, but it turns out they're all in the wrong place, because that isn't more typically people don't um and ah here, they um and ah here.
Right.
Yeah.
But also I think that part of the resistance to chatbots is that when you're on the receiving end, you feel slightly patronized because somebody thinks you are going to respond to this mechanized voice as if they were a person. And I think that if the more reality you bring into it in that way, as you're talking about, in a way, the more annoying that might be. And that really just, maybe they should just stick to providing information and not pretend to be a person.
Yeah, I think this does get us into the issue of, you know, what are you trying to convey to the user? And that you could argue that the sort of better and more human it is, the more we kind of kid the user into thinking that the chatbot can do everything. And that can then lead to problems as well. It's certainly the case that people can feel patronized without it being by a chatbot, but you probably don't want to design it into a chatbot.
Right. And then how does AI come into it then? Because chatbots have been around for a long time. Suddenly here comes AI promising to be a more intelligent chatbot, I suppose.
Yeah.
From your point of view, what is that going to do to the interaction with a chatbot?
I think it's partly a research question, but one of the things that I've been talking about today is actually doing this direct comparison of two people having a conversation on the phone and then actually getting ChatGPT to role play one of those parties, and you see immediately how painful it is, and hopefully what you can also learn from how painful it is when ChatGPT tries to take the part of what we see in this very straightforward conversation between Donnie and Marsha. It's a 30-second conversation. Donnie phones Marsha to basically ask for a lift because his car's broken down, but he never actually asks for a lift. He just says, guess what, my car is stalled. And Marsha figures out very quickly that he needs a ride, but she can't give him a ride. So she has to say, I can't give you a ride, but she never says that either. So he's never explicitly asking for a lift. She's never explicitly saying no, but somehow in 30 seconds, that's what happens.
Then, right. So that's a real conversation. That's a real conversation. You recorded.
Yeah.
And then?
Yeah. And then we, with great difficulty and great numbers of different prompts, we got ChatGPT to role play Marsha. So we fed in all of Donnie's lines and then we had a look at what ChatGPT did as Marsha. This was now a 3-minute conversation. and basically what you see is that ChatGPT isn't able to sort of, first of all, learn turn by turn, how to adapt turn by turn. And they also don't have any of the history that Donnie and Marsha have. And then Donnie and Marsha, it's very clear to us quickly that they're not really close, but they know each other well enough to have that type of conversation. The ChatGPT playing Marsha does this very labored, very laborious, very long responses that are all about not offering a ride, not even role-playing offering a ride, but instead doing advice and concern and are you safe? And it's just, it just takes a long time and it's very painful. And also because the one thing it has learned is that Donnie's called Donnie. It keeps dropping Donnie's name in all the wrong places as well.
Right. And so what was the point of this exercise? What were you trying to find out?
Well, initially as an academic, we were just interested to see what would happen. but what you quickly come to see is that the ChatGPT, at least at this point, cannot do what we would call recipient design, which is basically designing the interaction in this very agile, you know, almost breath by breath way that humans do it. It just can't do that because it just doesn't have all of the history. It's not really understanding what Donnie was doing right at the start, because Donnie starts by saying, guess what? And Marsha says, what? In the ChatGPT version, Donnie says, guess what? And ChatGPT says, oh, I'm not good at guessing games. Did you win something? And you just see that it just can't figure out that a guess what is a go. I need a go ahead so I can tell you what I'm calling for. It just does something completely crazy.
But one of the interesting things about AI is that I think even the people who invented it don't really know how it comes up with the answers that it does, because you can't, it's like in a way in the brain, you can't really see what it is in our brains that produces the result that comes that you're speaking. Do you think that from the point of view of sort of academic research, that actually how AI behaves could potentially throw light on the way we as humans actually do speak? Are we going to learn something from it about ourselves rather than it trying to just imitate us?
I mean, certainly in the case that I just explained, the sort of the Donnie Marsha conversation, the ChatGPT version tells us something about ourselves, which is how good we are at actually talking to
it
other human beings.
It really does. Might not have spotted otherwise.
Yeah. I mean, I can't answer the technical questions about AI, but it is also interesting that you sort of mentioned, you know, we don't really know what's going on in the brain necessarily when people produce talk. Obviously, in my home discipline of psychology, there's, you know, endless research on the brain, memory, cognition, language, and so on. But my field is quite different. We're less interested in what's going on under the skull and more interested in actually the sort of more behavior, like what is it that you can actually deal with? Because right now, you know, what's going on under my skull and what's going on under yours, we'll never know. And we have to have this conversation and we only have this evidence between us to make this conversation work. And that's almost every interaction you're having. So in the end, you've got to sort of think also pragmatically about if you're using AI tools, does it pragmatically help the user get something done or is it actually making that journey worse?
Well, it's a fascinating field. I just have one slightly more personal question. When you meet people and they say, what do you do? And you say, I analyze conversations. Does that make them incredibly inhibited or self-conscious? Or how do you sort of cope with people's reaction to being told what you do?
Yeah, I try to preempt it by saying, you know, I'm a psychologist and a conversation analyst, but don't worry, I'm not analysing everything that you're saying.
And in your own life, do you find you're reflecting and sort of editing your own response in conversations using your professional expertise? Or do you try
Hopefully
and avoid
not,
that?
Because, you know, the science of it is very slow because you're looking at recordings, you're looking at transcripts very slowly and your own interactions are running really quickly. That doesn't stop people sort of accusing me of analysing everything they're saying. That's definitely a thing that happens. And also, you know, if I'm not in the encounter, you know, people will often say, you know, could you look at this draft letter that I'm going to send? And so I, you know, those kinds of things are the points of connection between my professional life and my personal life. But mostly I'm just talking and making myself understood or not like everybody else.
Brilliant. Well, it's been really interesting. Thank you so much for talking to me, Elizabeth.
Thanks.
It's been great to chat to some real people here, especially Elizabeth and Craig. Thanks to them and to Alexa for all the help she's given me too.
Alexa, can you say goodbye from the Chatbot Summit for me?
Here is an answer from an Alexa Answers contributor that I translated. Go away.
Apologies on behalf of Alexa. Please join me, Charles Miller, next week for another CoinGeek Conversation.